The walls are piled high with boxes full of sub-assemblies and chunks of circuitry, and there's a lump in the corner that looks like hospital techny. Someone stirs in the back, sitting up and unfolding like a cut-price mockery of Dr. Murgatroyd, an Igor to his victor. "Why, hello, if it isn't my little Daggus!" The ocular turret gleams as it scans across me. "Julie? No. One of her sibs trying to pass for Bishojo?"
"No time for that now," says Dax. "I think we've got about half an hour at best. What can you do for her?"
I finish looking around and close my mouth with a snap.
"Now look here."
"Do you want them to catch you?"
asks Dax, cocking his head to one side and twitching an otoreceptor suggestively.
"Or not?"
Ferd throws his hands in the air.
"Really?"
The hands clatter noisily behind him as he shoves his wrists into a box and fumbles, muttering for a moment, then pulls them out again with new manipulators in place.
"A quick change at best and something about the hair, that is all, Daggus. You know how hard it is to disguise those legs and those eyes."
Forceps and scalpels glitter and flex in place of the fingers of his right hand. Retractors, lamps, and a miniature ocular turret on his left.
"Wait," I say hastily. "I've got a cover set, you know."
I dip into my jacket pocket and pull out the mounting tool and attachments for the Maria Monte's Guar eye turrets.
"Ah, a simple disguise."
Ferd leans close.
"Fascinating," he says, taking the mounting tool. "Lie down, my dear. I'll try to be fast, and I'll try not to hurt."
He glances at Dax.
"You'll owe me. Later, I tell you."
I lie down, and he installs the falsies, reinstating a goggle-like mask across my still bulbous eyes. He's fast, but not painless. Then he shaves my scalp, just as I was getting used to my hair again.
"Don't worry, I have a selection of wigs, merkins, too. You can choose one afterward."
He slides open my jacket, pushes it back to either side, and reaches for a pressurized tank.
"We'll go large, I think. That'll throw off your gait as well."
The spiked nozzle slides painlessly through my left aureole, and there's a sensation of bloated coldness as my breast begins to inflate.
"I'll make the other slightly smaller. Too much symmetry is bad."
As he pulls the barb loose, my swollen nipple pops up, spong, and bleeds a drop of clear blue fluid.
Skin colour.
"You have chromatophores, yes? General Instruments Squid Skin TM.
One of the good models. What's the factory setup command? Ah, yes."
In 20 minutes, Ferd does a quick fix on my shoulder, then gives me new hair, new cheekbones, a different nose, silver-blue skin, a bust bigger by 10 tender and turgid centimeters, and finally retunes my metatarsal shocks. With my heels fully extended, Catherine Sorico wouldn't be seen dead sporting such things, I'm 10 centimeters taller, but I can still run and jump. Of course, when I retract them again, I'm going to be hobbling for days afterward, but that's not the point. He's hit the high points. My gait is different, my eye and facial metrics altered, and I'm not immediately recognizable, at least not to somebody who doesn't already know me. It won't last long before my techne reverts me back to the design that Dr. Murgatroyd implanted so deeply. But it'll do for now.
"Right! Out! Out, I say!"
Ferd positively shouts me off his operating table. He rushes us into a back passage that I hadn't noticed on our way in.
"Grab a wig and an outfit on your way. Be seeing you, Daggus." Ha ha.
I pause to loot my pockets and grab a shoulder bag, then pick up a copper gold wig and a frilled red lace leotard.
New identity time, calls Dax. You're called Kate. You're an exotic dancer. You work in, I pull on the leotard, the Blue Moon on Kirovstrasse. And your speciality is aristo fetishists. Everything's set up for you already.
Typical.
I scramble to fasten the outfit, texture my skin to sketch in underwear and shoes beneath it, and grab a somewhat battered jacket with built-in heaters. Then I hurry after Dax, who hasn't stopped moving.
Where now?
We split.
He thrusts a wallet at me. If they're coming after you openly, then your existing bolt hole is blown. Shit's hitting the turbine, full force. Jeeves says Mars isn't safe for anyone, least of all you. Give her this kit, and tell her to meet him on Callisto. He'll be in touch later if it's safe.
Callisto?
I blink my aching eyes and heft the wallet. We're back out in the cold, walking past a row of doss houses and cheap body shops.
Don't worry, you're on payroll now. There's a soul chip in there that explains everything. It's an update from Juliet.
Plus there are 3 changes of identity. Boss wants you in Jupiter system, stat.
You call in when you get there, but try not to take more than 4 years over it, kay?
Thanks.
Bye!
With that, Dax lifts on a jet of compressed gas and zips away across the moonlit shantytown, staying in Nap of Mars. I shiver for a moment, look around, notice the lengthening shadows, and slide into them, doing my best impression of a non-victim who knows what she's doing in the barrio after dark. Coin-operated boy. I make it to the nearest tube station. En route, nobody tries to mug, assault, rape, enslave, or strip me down for spare parts. Which is no bad thing, really, because I'm in no mood for it. I walk the whole way with my hand in that shoulder bag, clutching the gun I took from Stone, and I'm angry, which is a bad combination. It's not just a gun. You can fold the chamber back, stick your fingers through the hole in the skeletal butt, and it's a knuckle duster. Flip a catch and twist it, and it sprouts a stiletto blade. And there's always the revolver. His choice of weapon says it all about Stone, I think. Flamboyant, but not necessarily effective. I use the Maria Monte's Guar cash card for the first ride, but it's a private capsule, and I'm only going as far as a public interchange, and by the time I bounce out onto the platform, I've activated the card in Jeeves' little care package and gotten my story rebooted. The card in the wallet Dax passed me isn't just gilt-edged. It contains a line of credit on an account that claims to have the thick end of 50,000 reals in it. That's more money than I've ever seen in one place in my life. I could live modestly on the capital for a century, or invest it foolishly and lose my glad rags again in a matter of months. It's not quite enough to charter a fast yacht back to Earth, but it's not far short. This demands some serious thought, when I get to stop running. I catch a public train to Downwell Terminus, then buy a first-class ticket on the Ares Express to Lowell. From the lounge car of the train, I buy a classier outfit, for delivery when I arrive, and a sub-hop ticket to Barsoom at the far end of Valles Marineris. Then I notice the chip in the bottom of the wallet. Stricken, I remember the graveyard. It's back in my room. What should I do? I take a calculated risk and wait until we're nearing Lowell, then call a public factotum service 2 steps down from and entirely unconnected with Jeeves Co. I need a parcel abstracting from a rented apartment and mailing to a third party, I say, and zap them the Maria Monte's Guar ID. I pay with her wallet, then leave it in the lounge car's trash recycler when I exit the train. The graveyard will, perforce, have to go to Samantha in Denver or Rachel in Kuala Lumpur. For now, it's just me and Juliet, and the strange soul chip Jeeves has sent me. I must have fool tattooed on my forehead in mirror writing.
I pause in one of the travel temples at Lowell for long enough to change into my new outfit, then slip the new chip in to replace Juliet's. Then I head for the departure lounge to await my suborbital flight and settle down to catch half an hour's nap while I wait. I wasn't expecting to dream myself into Juliet's mind so fast. Not after I just replaced her older chip with a newer release. But my expectations don't seem to have much to do with what happens to me these days. And so I find myself remembering being Juliet, reliving her own memories recursively, specifically a memory of floating with Jeeves in his command module, contemplating the memory chip that she's just handed to him. Although I am somewhat surprised by it. It's like looking into a mirror and seeing the back of your own head. "Thank you, my dear," says Jeeves, carefully tucking the chip away in a pocket of his immaculately tailored jacket. "She's going to have adventures, too, whoever she is." "You're going too far, boss man," says Dax, turning to me. "You realize that alienating our labor isn't enough for him. Now he's trying to alienate our identities." "Stow it, space hound," Jeeves says, not unkindly. He glances at me, Juliet, and scowls. One might think from his attitude that we owned him. "His bark is worse than his bite," I say automatically. All the while hoping like hell that Jeeves doesn't know what he's got in his hands. Or rather, what he doesn't have. Because if he does, I could be in a world of hurt. "What next?" Jeeves smiles and prefers me a new soul chip. "You might as well put this in. Your next mission." I, Juliet, open my eyes. Which is bizarre and disturbing to do when you're dreaming, but bear with me, please. We're sitting on a chaise at one end of a grand ballroom, the centerpiece of some aristo's dream of decadence on Mars. Someone, our host, is throwing a party on an epic scale. I'm here under an elaborate and expensive cover identity that feels familiar, as if I've used it before, but I can't quite put my finger on it. The theme is historical. Our host is in character as the mistress of a South American dictator, who on the eve of a disastrous war held a grand ball and demanded that all the nobility of her nation attend, with their wives and daughters wearing their family jewelry. Our host has spared no expense to recreate the original event. We're all costumed after the fashion of the court of Eliza Lynch. As long as there are no firing squads in the courtyard outside, I shall be content, for the diamonds on my jeweled hair combs are synthetic, and the metals themselves are industrial commodities. But as for the rest of it... She's built a replica of the Grand Palace of Ascension on the Hellas Basin, beneath a geodesic dome paned in sheets of sapphire-coated glass. Turbid river water steams beneath a Fresnel lens-focused sun, surrounded by artificial macro-sized green replicators, their dendritic structural members and fractal photovoltaic converters supporting splashes of very un-Martian hues. Tiny dinosaurs flutter and scream in the branches, adding yet more period color, for this was the high era of unrestricted DNA replication, before the big dieback that preceded our creator's own exit. Crowds of dark-skinned servants carry trays laden with drink and small morsels of intricately structured feedstock through the crowd of resplendently gowned and tailored aristos. There are more tall people here than I would normally see in a year. Our creators tended to build their personal assistants to their own scale, and thus giants are overrepresented among the aristocratic elite. But there's no shortage of doll-sized tyrants, the new blood incarnate. I circulate discreetly, a goblet of viscous red liqueur in one gloved hand, trying to keep my elaborate costume from sweeping up any of the smaller partygoers, eyes hidden behind a diamond-rimmed mask. In the bangles dangling from my earlobes, I carry concealed cameras and signal processing equipment. Jeeves sent me to follow up a rumour that she is holding a meeting here today. There are cabals and conspiracies among the aristos, for although the intricate political system of our creators withholds from us the status of active participants, and thus is stalled, deadlocked, and silenced in the absence of even a minimal quorum for any of the 100 legislatures they bequeathed us, the dance of politics proceeds by other means, savage and knife-silent. I'm here tonight to see as much as a minor aristo like the Honourable Catherine Sorico might be allowed to glimpse of certain plans. Which is somewhat ironic, but I really oughtn't to think too hard about that while I'm wearing my soul trip. Over here, I pass a string quartet, sawing away at their instruments with dogged persistence. I try not to wince. Even Moody Freya with her hurdy-gurdy would be an improvement over these poor damned souls. Arbiter musicians, enslaved by an override chip, can't help but broadcast their despair when they play. Over there, a fire-eater juggles blazing oxygen candles while reeling on a unicycle. I pass a gaggle of munchkins bundled up in silk and fullerene lace, loudly placing bets on a pair of slowly circling slaves who reluctantly slice strips from one another with blunt, flaying knives. This I try to ignore. It would do them no good, and my mission less, to vent my rage on these braying ruffians. Besides, I remind myself, if the Black Talon really is to organize a puppet show, we're all in the same ring as these slaves. Black Talon? That corner of me that is Freya wonders confusedly. Jeeves mentioned them. I'm so busy ignoring the butcher's floor that I walk straight into another partygoer who is seemingly likewise preoccupied. I trip on the hem of my fancy dress gown and plant my face on the shoulder of his black velvet frock coat. He catches my hand before I realize I'm holding a goblet, and I blink and realize he's holding me upright. "Why, hello," he says, with a faint smile. "I must apologize. I'm sorry," I begin. Then I look into the eyes behind his mask and smell his skin. And time stands still. And I open my eyes reluctantly, back in my own head, in the Aristo lounge of the Barsoom liftport.
10 minutes to boarding, mistress," says the timid waitron, retreating back to the niche by the door.
I nod, too tired to care. Who do I think I'm kidding? I ask myself, running to Barsoom, changing my clothes, my face, my name at every stop, obeying orders to meet a strange employer, half-glimpsed through second-hand memories, on Callisto. Meanwhile, my real life rots in self-inflicted neglect. My arm's-length relationship with my sibs is punctuated by increasingly long silences. My few real friends are scattered across the inner solar system. I was a fool back on Venus, I think bitterly. The voyage to Jupiter will take months, at best, years if not. And what for? I don't really know what Jeeves is up to, although I'm haunted by disturbingly political memories. And there's Emma with her scandalous talk of an inner circle within our sisterhood, and Juliet's strange memories of cloak and dagger, and Jeeves with his fears of infiltration, and these Black Talon people who seem to think I hold a piece of the puzzle. Almost without noticing, I find I'm calling up my mail drop service and supplying my own unveiled authenticators. Freya Nakamichi 47 wants to talk. Can anybody hear me? I'll be out of here in 10 minutes, I rationalize, and then I'll be gone. 6 new letters, 3 with imagos attached, download themselves into my pad. Then a blinking red-rimmed warning comes up. Attention, unauthorized user. Huh? I wonder. User ID revoked. Corporation 468-7245-72103, declared bankrupt pursuant to civil claim. In liquidation. Assets subject to seizure. The court order pulses at me, and I disconnect convulsively, my skin cold and clammy with fear. What on earth? I quickly check my current name, but it's clean. I shudder and stand up. Numinous dread fills me. Civil claim. Bankruptcy. My legal personhood has been suspended. Someone wants to own me, I realize. But who and why? Who would do that to me? I shudder again, biomimetic reflexes winning out. Someone wants to take me by force. The suborbital hop doesn't take long. A minute of acceleration, then free fall for almost 4,000 kilometers, terminated by a hammering pulse of deceleration and touchdown on a smoking concrete pad 10 kilometers outside Barsoom. It's almost noon, and we're entering the long Martian summer, so I catch the tube halfway into town and walk the rest of the way. Or rather, I bounce. When I arrive, I've switched identities and outfits again. Back to good time girl Kate. Barsoom is a one-locomotive town, surrounded by atmosphere plantations, ore extraction facilities, and the remains of a huge abandoned terraforming complex. It's seen better days, as has the cheap dive I check myself into. The Barsoom Ibis was probably once a refined center of upmarket accommodation, but with the increasing tendency of aristos to entertain their own at home, it's had to hold its nose and take what it can get. I ghost unseen past the decaying finery in the lobby and trudge up an empty seventh-floor corridor toward my underfurnished, peeling-walled room. In my room, I remove my eye turrets, use the ultrasonic cleaner, purge my waste bladder, and settle down to work. "Meet me on Callisto," says Jeeves. That's easier said than done. Especially as someone's just tried to legally enslave me. One of my selves is screaming in the back of my head. A quick search of the shipping pages reveals the depressing truth. Mars to Jupiter demands a whole load of Delta V. A straightforward home and transfer orbit, the cheapest, takes 3.5 years. And the launch window only opens up once every Martian year, just under once every 2 Earth years. Even worse, Mars and Jupiter are nearing opposition right now, adding nearly 4 astronomical units, 600 million kilometers, to the high Delta V flight path. So the normally fast M2P2 MagSail ships spend a good part of their voyage tacking against the solar wind. You can get it down to just a year, if you've got the money to pay for passage on a fast VASIMR liner. But the mass ratio is so poor that you'll want to take the trip in hibernation. For every kilogram that arrives, 20 set off. On anything faster than a Hohmann transfer, the excess baggage charges are so monstrous that travellers have been known to amputate their limbs before departure and buy new ones on arrival. Finally, then, there are the nuclear rockets, but they're out of my price range. I'm not a millionaire. I check ticket prices for someone of my mass out of idle curiosity. If I was Dax, it'd be affordable. But every way I plan the trip, I end up 16,000 reels over budget. I could make the figures line up if I ditched an arm as well as both legs, but a quick check of body shop prices tell me I'd only be able to afford a hook and a pair of cheap caterpillar tracks at the other end. Resigned, I save the calculations for later. It's still early afternoon, but the fun and games of running all night have really taken it out of me, on top of the damage I sustained when that little shit stone tagged me at the museum. I call room service for a pile of tasty feedstock, being careful how I answer the door this time. Then lock myself in, lie down on the bed, and gingerly enter deep sleep maintenance mode. When I sleep, I have dreams. This is not unusual. Our creators use dreaming as a mechanism for reinforcing memory pathways. Our neural architecture is almost a straight copy of theirs. They found no other way
to build intelligent servants, and we too must sleep, perchance to dream. Sometimes my dreams are deeply erotic. This too is normal. It's part of what our creators called the human condition. Short of neutering some vital reward pathways, without which I would be unable to perform my core designated function, or even get up in the morning, it's not possible to do away with it, even if it was desirable to do so. But this is something else. I'm with him, at her party. I am inflamed, sweat-slick slippery, and nearly adrift from my fancy dress, underwear soaked right through. We walk sedately, arm in arm, along a garden path, and though I may lean a little too close to him, it's probably unremarkable to the eyes and ears watching us. What I'm feeling isn't obvious from the outside. I'm very well practiced at masking my appearance. But my circulatory pumps are throbbing, and I'm light-headed with lust. It's not just his eyes. It's the smell. I don't need to look or touch. Just feeling the awkwardness of his gait and listening to the catch in his breath tells me that it's mutual. Something I've never felt before was happening to me. And I'm not alone. "Call me Kate," I whisper. "How delightful. Charmed to meet you, Midia. Call me Pete." I glance sidelong at him, meeting those eyes again. "No. Really?" He seems amiably amused. "Really? What delightful eyes you're wearing. Are they really yours?" "No. I'm in fancy dress. You know what I am." His hand tightens on my wrist. It feels so much like Rhea's memory of her first love, that I'm almost lost, then and there. I bite my lip to keep a tiny moan from escaping. "Where are you taking me?" "My host maintains a hothouse where she grows flowers," he says. "It's off limits to most, but I can sneak you in if you like." He smiles wryly. "Perhaps you'd like to see her precious orchid." I pause to lean on his shoulder, nearly melting in the steamy heat. "I'd love to," I manage, fanning myself. I've lost the wine glass somewhere along the way, and I don't care. I know I really ought to pull my soul chip at this point, but I'm past worrying. "Please." I look at him. With my heels extended, we're of nearly equal height. And he inclines his head slowly, and I kiss him, hungrily. I can't help myself. Something about him tastes good. He pulls back after an indefinite minute and looks at me. With the mask obscuring half his face, it's hard to be sure, but there's something slightly vacuous about his expression, almost as if he isn't sure I'm real. "Now?" he asks, sounding faintly alarmed. Time passes. We're walking between walls, through a maze, hands clasped together. Slabs of paving whirl underfoot, and then we're in a clearing where a dome of flaring green glass rises gracefully from the ground. There's a door. Pete does something, and it opens. He turns, and I fall into his arms. He carries me inside, mewling pathetically, and fumbling with the frogging of his coat, and closes the door behind us. And I awaken in the dark in my shabby hotel room, surrounded by a puddle of cold lube with my legs apart, shuddering close to the edge of orgasm in a pale, lonely shadow of Juliet's encounter. Her precious orchid, who calls himself Pete. A lot of things are clear, including the danger I'm in. Damn! I roll over and punch the bedding into submission. People like Pete are rare, Our creators had strange attitudes to sex. Their hang-ups loom over us like the shadows of bad dreams. And females seem to have been less inclined than males to buy servants such as I. Or perhaps it was less socially acceptable. Or maybe the servants simply didn't last as well. Make of it what you will, there are fewer than 100 of my lineage left. And perhaps only 12 lineages of our kind. Our male equivalents are rarer still, either enslaved and worked to destruction, or sequestered in the seraglios of those aristos rich enough to own them. At a guess, Pete accepted an offer like the one Granita made me aboard the Pygmalion. How inconvenient. We're conditioned to submit to our creators when we recognize them. But when we meet our one true love, our designated owner, we're supposed to yield to them utterly. Pete, whoever he was, played power chords on Juliet's triggers. She knew, in the abstract, that the atmosphere was 90% carbon dioxide at 40 degrees Celsius, as I did when I met Jeeves for the first time on Mercury, but she also knew, in her nipples and clitoris and trembling knees, that Pete was the real thing. Because he smelled right. There's more to being a convincing source of sexual superstimuli than just a pretty face. And our creators made sure that those of us intended as their playthings could also turn them on. Juliet began to imprint on Pete. My sister, in the throes of helpless love? We have a special term for that. Spoiled goods. The only ray of hope shining from behind the dark cloud is that Pete began reacting the same way to her. Penetrating her aristo disguise, he responded to her as if she was a creator lady and his true mistress, with whom he must fall in love, not simply his owner. They're in a feedback loop, and by the time they snap out of it, they won't be the same people anymore. I bring my knees up to my chest and slide a hand between my thighs, shuddering as I remember their first convulsive rut, the mutual desperation and tender ocean of need. I'm aghast at the strength of it, and desolated. Is this true love? If so, it seems to involve as much loss of self-control as being mind-raped by a slaver's control chip. The worst thing about it was how good it felt. If it happened to me, I know for sure that I wouldn't care about the vacation of my free will.